This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Surgical Procedures Sub-Team Track 2 Legal Regulatory Issues held on the 19th of January, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room only. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing your names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Michael Fleming. Please begin.
Good morning, good evening, and good night. Well, I can't say goodnight. I'm not sure if that's the best greeting in the world, but still, again, thank you everyone for joining us today. Today we have a very exciting topic for plan for us. We have the registrant protections. We're going to be looking at the COI, some critical registry functions, as well as the more nitty-gritty of the COI, the LLC, and other aspects such as that. This was a meeting that was not originally planned, so I want to thank everyone again. A special thanks for joining us on this fun Thursday and Friday morning for those of us here in the APAC. I'm just going to go ahead and jump right into the SOI update. Does anyone have an updated SOI for us to know about? Hearing none, if there is an update, please go ahead and put it to the chat. Terry, I don't know if I have slide scroll function on here. Okay, are you guys going to do it?
You know, what's your preference, Michael, and we can make it happen either way.
I think if you hand it to me, I think we give you one less task to worry about.
Perfect. You're a host now. You can turn the slide, and so can you, right. Phil.
I can hear the meeting, too, really, huh? No. So we're just going to jump right into the registrant protections. And for this, my apologies, I'm going to be turning it over to Phil Buckingham, actually, to take over the discussion. So, Phil, could you go ahead and jump on in?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming on this call. Obviously, it's rearranged call just before NedgeCon, so I guess a lot of people couldn't make it, so thank you for taking the time to be on the call and see if you can help us out solve these various problems that we have with the COI, your bureau. Steve, are you going to take over scrolling up and down for me, please? That would be great, so we could kick this off with a bit of a background on the current situation. That'll be good. So, yeah, so basically, the key thing is this Principle D, which is bringing out here, you all read it yourself. Backtracking a little bit, so keep everybody toes here. How many of you actually had a client or were an applicant and you had a problem with anything to do with question 50 of the COI and the Bureau? Maybe we could have or put your hands up, those that had a client or were an applicant themselves and had a problem with this whole area. Just to get a general idea, because I think it proved to be a real headache for lots of us. There's lots of issues to address and obviously try and sort out for round two. So could we have a show of hands to see who was in that predicament and situation. I certainly was with my clients. So, yeah, how many? So, Rubens, Heather, for starters. Yeah. Okay, so the vast majority of you have come across the issues to do with COI, so we haven't got any beginners in here that don't understand it. Anybody like to say something in the chat? Their situation? Oh, anyway.
But why don't we jump into... why don't we go through the background information?
So let's jump into the background information here. So basically, the crux of it is the... behind the whole of the applicant guidebook is the issue, is the overriding requirement that the stability and security of the internet is secure, basically. So therefore, you know, when we talk about the technical evaluation, the financial evaluation, the overriding requirement is the technical evaluation. When they did it, was the override, the DNS was still stable and secure. And from a financial point of view, when they did the financial evaluation, also it was the applicant had to demonstrate their ability to understand and plan for the business contingencies and afford protections in the marketplace. So, So, basically, when they, can we scroll up onto the second page, please? Yeah, so basically, we move forward to the critical registry functions. So what was happening was each applicant had to basically answer various questions, 50 questions, and question 50 was they had to show, they had to put in place a letter of credit, and they had to calculate the critical registry functions that cost them out in terms of what, in terms of the number of domains under management that they were, and therefore there was a chart that was put up that was calculated by the back end providers to work out how much the critical registry functions would cost. And the critical registry functions here, we can see them on the screen, basically five of them, DNS resolution for registered domain names, operation of a shared registry system, operation of registry data directory services, who is registry escrow deposits, and a maintenance of properly signed zone in accordance with the DNS set requirements. So, so basically there was a chart put up that each applicant had to figure out the costs on those registry functions. So can we scroll it up a bit? So the question that's coming about is, do you think these critical registry functions are still sufficient? Do we need to change them for round two? What's your thoughts on this?
Jeff, go ahead.
Thanks. This is Jeff Newman. So I guess the context around this question, just to maybe elicit some other feedback, in getting to think about overall registrant protections, one of the protections that ICANN stated was a concrete protection for registrants was the notion of being able to step in and cover if a registry failed. And these were the five services in the slide before that ICANN deemed, or the community deemed, were sufficient to back up a registry if there was a failure. And the question I think this refers to should be, in thinking about the registries that have launched to date, is there anything other than those five functions that the community may deem to be critical, such that a backup registry should be able to take over? So, for example, if there was a failure of the .bank TLD, would these five functions be enough to back up that registry with all of the validations and everything else that they have in place? Or is there any other protections that are needed? Or does it depend on the type of registry? So this is kind of the feedback we're looking for before we talk about COI and an EBRO. So if there's any feedback that anybody has on other functions that you may think might be critical, now's the time to kind of provide that feedback.
I mean, this is a, I can jump in here. This is a very technical area. So, to be honest with you, it goes over my head. It's, the technical issues to run a registry, the back-end technical issues. So, are these five critical registry functions, are they sufficient, or should there be some more that's come about since 2012? So we have no response. So do we assume that they are therefore sufficient? Therefore, every one of you is going to say yes. No, they don't need changing in any shape or form.
Phil, Michael here. I have my hand raised as well. Cheryl, in the participant. Actually, I'm just going to, Cheryl, do you mind if I just jump in really quick?
Please go ahead, Michael, please.
All right, thank you. This is not necessarily something I think specifically, but there was a discussion raised a little bit a while ago about whether or not such registry, critical registry functions should include, for example, would be additional services that are added by the RCEP. I try not to put out names and anything, but this is only if you consider it a critical function, of course. But, for example, DONUS has the DPML block that is not necessarily a critical registry function. However, if something were to happen, just to make sure that function itself would be able to carry, that service would be able to carry over in such a situation where EBRO is necessary, should we consider looking at that or making changes to add where services added by an RCEP are also critical registry functions? Should we look at making such a change like that? That's just one idea that has been provided in the past. And then, Cheryl, straight to you.
Well, thank you, Michael, and I'm delighted I said please go ahead because I was working on a gut reaction, and then, of course, you've given me a perfect example to strengthen my case. I do appreciate that when that happens. My gut reaction to at least the question of Phil when he suggested, or sorry, Jeff when he indicated, is this something that may be different for different types, was it may very well be, and that's why I put my hand up, because I think we may need to have a set of core critical functions which are overarching regardless of what your TLD is, classifiable or otherwise, if we do or don't use types, et cetera, et cetera. Because there's still some other moving parts in other bits of this PDT working group that will affect this. But I do think that if we're looking from reasonable expectations of the licensees of the names, your example of the higher order specific stuff, such as the bank, is a really good one to use. It's changed under RCEP. Hang on, these are things that your emergency back-end provider may very well simply be unable to provide unless it's costed into the model. So I think we need a core set and a if this, then that set. Now, we couldn't, I suspect, be too specific, but there may be language with the assistance of our legal people that, and I don't mean necessarily ICANN legal, although I'll get involved eventually, I mean all of the legal people we have in our PDP group, where we can come up with something. But to me, this is just a core set of critical registry functions, but depending on what is being offered in the first place to your registrants, on failure, these would not cover some of what are mission critical to the businesses reliant on the services provided. So we need to do some work and some thinking about that. But I may regret asking this question. Was it purely the technical nature of some of the questions that caused everybody who had clients and such great problems on this costing estimate? Or is it the fact that nobody likes to put more money away than they possibly have to? Thanks.
Yeah.
So, Cheryl, after you,
Michael.
Sorry, Phil, I'm just going to just go with that really quickly. So, Cheryl, you ask a lot of good points and a lot of good questions. First of all, we do consider whether look at the brand aspect of the not necessarily just the brand, of course, but we do look at considering whether or not the COA itself is necessary for different categories and a separate tone, but considering whether or not the same critical registry functions would be necessary or if an overarching are these the overarching critical registry functions. I really like that way of thinking because it's not something we considered up until this point. We also have some really good conversation going on in the chat. Jeff, you had your hand up a few moments ago. I'm going to assume that is no longer Hanson's not there. Some interesting conversation going on in the chat. I think if we could just kind of grab what is in there in the chat and bring it over to the notes, it'd be really good. If not, I think we should probably move forward a little bit. Unless anyone has anything else they need to say before, or I said, unless anyone is going to die if they don't say something else. No? Okay, Jeff, go ahead.
I'm not going to die, but I think there is some good conversation in the chat that probably should be brought up in the front areas, and that is the notion of, if you go back a slide to the critical functions, the one slide before, it talks about the maintenance of a shared registration system as being one of the critical functions, or operation of a shared registration system. It's actually coming out in the chat that there are, it's really not the entire shared registration system that's critical. And in fact, if there's an EBRO that's ever called in question, there would only be modifications that would be allowed to the registrations and potentially renewals, but not the addition of new domains. The EBRO would not be responsible for adding it. It was initially thought that that would eliminate, as I think Rubens may have said in the chat, that it eliminates the policy layer, in other words, having to implement policy. The problem with renewals, though, is that some registries do validate renewals just like they validate the initial registration. And therefore, if we truly take out the EBRO from implementing policy, it would also not be allowed to do renewals in those particular CLBs where renewals are validated or the information submitted for renewals is validated. I don't know if that affects the cost of maintenance of an EBRO or not in terms of lessening, but it's not really the operation of a shared registration system that's critical. It's operation of certain features of a shared registration system that is critical. And I don't know if we need to break that down further or not, but just for the point of, as Kurt says in the chat, there might be renewals in EBRO environment. Does that require SRS? And the answer is yes, but again, if there's policy that affects renewals, then the EBRO is not going to be able to do it.
Thanks, Jeff. That's an aspect I didn't even consider before. That whether or not it's at least these five are the critical registry functions, but even then, they're limited in certain areas as well, in which would that affect cost or not. Cheryl and Jeff, I'm assuming these are old hands? Okay, I'm going to assume those are old. Phil, do we want to move on, or do we want to stick on this topic a little bit longer?
Well, I think, I don't know what other people think, but this is a very technical, complicated area, isn't it? It really is.
It is, and there's I think there's more understanding, more background information that should be prepared before we are able to understand it fully. But we do have a lot of subject material. There's still a conversation to be continued on the chat. We'll capture the heart of the conversation on the chat and to have it added to our agenda or our notes. But if we could continue for the slides.
If we could scroll up, that would be great. So there's these thresholds that have been put in place within a matrix. If these thresholds are breached, then technically the transition will have to go ahead. The question is, are these sufficient, or should they be increased? I mean, how did they arrive at these thresholds? Where do we go from here on this? Because at the precise moment in time, as far as I'm aware, this has never been triggered. Do we have any statistics on this from ICANN? Whether these thresholds have been breached by any registry?
Phil, just before we jump into questions a little bit, just to provide a little bit more background information, I'm sorry, Phil, basically these are the emergency thresholds that are copied directly out of the registry agreement. I'm sure many of you have seen them. Basically, it's 10%. It's about 10% of the emergency thresholds before these are triggered, or at least the emergency escalation will trigger on ICANN's side. This is what is in the contract. This is what everyone has probably seen 1,000 times, 1,001 if you're Rubens. Just kidding. But the question that we wanted to add here basically was, has any registry ever gone above the EBRO? And as Phil said, this is probably data that is not necessarily released out there. What we do know is that ICANN has done some retiring TLDs in order to test the process, but up until now, we don't know whether or not the EBRO has been used specifically, or if any registry has actually gone above that emergency threshold in the past. So if we could maybe try, if you'd be able to provide some feedback on this would be very helpful. But Jeff also has his hand raised, so I'll go directly to him.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that actually breaks into a couple different questions, too. I think we do need the data from ICANN, but I think without attributing it, so we wouldn't want to hear who the registry is. But there's two questions. One, has any registry reached the emergency threshold before? And then a second question is, has the EBRO ever been used? And you could kind of join those and say, has an EBRO not been used even when someone goes over the emergency threshold? And the reason I ask that question is if you go to the emergency threshold for WHOIS, so let's say WHOIS is down for 24 hours, it would be my belief, although I have no evidence, and it's a question for ICANN, if a registry had come back within 24 hours and said, hey, look, it's going to take me an additional 5 hours above the 24 hours fix the WHOIS, I don't think ICANN would go spin off the EBRO because that's actually a lot of work, and it would be more work getting to an EBRO and back than it would be to let a registry go above the threshold. Now, DNS may be a little bit different because that's kind of the core registry function, or much more core than WHOIS or data escrow. So it would be good to get statistics from ICANN if the emergency threshold has ever been reached, question one. Two, has the EBRO ever been utilized? And three, if someone was above the emergency threshold, was there ever a case in which the EBRO was not utilized, and why? I think those are interesting questions. understand a little bit more about the threshold and what goes into ICANN determination. I will tell you it's a little bit the who is being down for 24 hours. I would be one from a personal viewpoint to say that would not be or should not trigger Ebro. I know it's inconvenient and it's not great to happen, but for who is to be up there in terms of 24 hours to trigger a new operator coming in with all the costs of that, I don't think would be useful. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff, for those feedback.
Trang's made a comment in the chat. I don't know if the Ebro has been officially triggered. We could check if that was a request from the work track. And yeah, could we request that, Trang? And could you come back to us on that? Whether actually the Ebro has actually been officially triggered? I suspect not.
I do agree with Phil. I think that'd be good. And I think we'd probably want two sets of, data there. One is, has the emergency threshold to make that clear, has anyone gone above the emergency threshold and whether or not the Ebro has actually been triggered? That's actually our next question as well. So sorry, we had two questions that probably should have gone through both slides, but agreeing with Phil, we'd like, if we could, we'd really appreciate to have two sets of data there. Thank you, Trey.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to know the stats. So say the threshold was down for 40 hours, or there was one that was down for 50 hours, what the stats are on it, because maybe what we should be looking to do is increase those thresholds. So it's downtime, maybe it's 48 hours downtime in a week, or I don't know. But maybe we have to look at, we have to analyze the stats and to see what they show. That would answer the question. Yeah, so shall we move on to the next slide then, please?
I don't see anyone raising their hand, so I figure we... what's the good old pioneer word? We travel on. Okay, you go with it, Phil.
Okay, so let's scroll up, please. Can we do that, Steve? Thanks. Okay, so from my distant memory, what happened was when we had to calculate this. Critical registry functions, and obviously that was based on domains under management. Now, obviously, what a number of applicants did was they obviously, in order, because this is tied in with the letter of credit, so they downgrade their number of domains under management in their business model, so therefore they'd have to come up with a lesser number for their letter of credit. So it's a tricky one. There are ranges to set up the cost for these to calculate these domains under management at different levels. So the question is, are these levels correct? I guess how was this arrived at? So X cost for domains under management under 10,000, and when they rose above 300,000, how were these costs arrived at? And who did them? How was it set up within ICANN? I mean, is there any any information that I can add to how they arrived at these calculations?
So we've got Rubens and we've got Jeff with their hands raised. Do you want to go with the questions, or do you want to
sure. Go ahead, Rubens. Maybe you know more than me, a lot more than me, it seems. You there, Rubens?
Thank you, Phil. Just want to point out that these costs are activation costs, but Ebro also has readiness costs. So there is a target icon base for the possible Uber providers for them to be ready. And there is cost to actually engage in...
Ruben, you're very quiet.
So their icon currently has both cost lines. Register operators are being charged, I believe, the activation cost, but not the ongoing cost, at least not on the Ibero line. Icon is probably getting that money from the daily fees that every TLD pays. But Ibero has these two cost vectors, not just one. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, Rubens, you weren't very clear. That was very difficult to understand.
To summarize what Ruben said was that for the cost involved here, there's two costs. There's the activation cost as well as the ongoing one. The COI specifically looks at the activation costs, and then the ongoing costs are paid out, but which that was the portion I was unable to hear. I believe that was what he said. If Jeff, you are next if you want to provide input on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. First of all, I'll give input as to where this all came from, and then I might address that and some other kind of weird facets of this whole program. So where it came from is, and Kurt can jump into if I misstate something, but there was an RFP or RFI, I forgot what it was called, for entities that were interested in serving as an Ibero. And through those responses, ICANN had asked for estimates or cost estimates of what it would cost or what those Ibero's would charge ICANN in order to serve in that Ibero capacity. And it received a number of responses, and if I remember correctly, probably could have been almost 20 responses, but at least 10. And out of those proposals, ICANN, I guess, you know, looked at an average or looked at whatever it did and analyzed those proposals to come up with those costs based on what these responses said that they would charge ICANN to do that work. So that's where the numbers came from, and maybe Kurt can fill me in if I was a little bit off on that. It was a number of years ago. I think it was 2010 or maybe 2011 where that was done. And so I think that's number one. Number two, kind of weird part about this is ICANN talks about Ibero in terms of business failure. Yet Ibero only comes into play if there's technical failure. So it's only if the business fails and that business failure causes a technical failure in which Ibero is brought up. So in theory, if there's only business failure, in theory, the registry technical backend should still be up, unless it wants to give up because it's not getting paid, which I'm not sure a backend operator would. So there's a lot of kind of things that would need to happen in order to actually trigger an Ibero to coming into play. But putting that aside, the question is, and I think maybe it's talking to ICANN and the Ibero providers as to what true amounts would be to bring up an Ibero and how often it's brought up, which we know it hasn't been brought up yet. And then in theory, take that information, figure out how much ICANN would need to fund an Ibero provider. And rather than doing, you know, my proposal would be rather than doing one, COI per each registry is figuring out a different way to fund the Ibero where you know its costs will be covered. But that's probably moving on a little bit further ahead.
Jeff, I want to argue a little bit with you, mainly in the form of the question, with which true amounts would bring it up in Ebro, because, I'm sorry, if we scroll back up to the sixth slide here, what we have in our contract already states that once the specific threshold line is met here, that what the emergency escalation would actually take place. I think the question we might want to actually look at a bit more in detail is this contractually the correct amount in a way? Just because if these lines have been met already and an emergency escalation has not technically been triggered, I mean, not to saying that anybody wants Ebro to happen, of course, but we're contractually bound specifically for this amount. So the true amount, to me, would have to follow this. But Jeff, go ahead with your response.
So I just want to clarify something you said. We are contractually bound to agree that ICANN has the right at its discretion to move this over to an Ebro, but it's ICANN's discretion as to whether it does or does not. So it's not a contractual, like, once this level is hit, ICANN must then move it to an Ebro provider. What ICANN truly would do in this situation, most likely, and I was involved in some early discussions, is that if a registry, a technical back end, remember, this is not really a business failure, but a technical failure, if there were a registry that said, yes, I know my EPP is down, it's going to be down longer than 24 hours, but I'll have it up within 30, there's no way that ICANN is going to, or ICANN should, pull up an Ebro, undergo all that expense. That'll probably take more than 6 hours anyway, so especially with having to get changes put into the route. So I just think these are important factors to take into consideration. And I also think that when we discuss this issue, we should not be discussing it in terms of a business failure of a registry, but more of a technical failure from the, in most cases, registration service provider, which may or may not be the same as the registry.
Kurt
brings up a good point as well on the chat. It said ICANN initiates the emergency escalation, but it doesn't necessarily transfer it to an Ebro.
I can take that back, of course. My English is not what it used to be. I can completely relate with Kurt on that. Yes, a little bit of ambiguity in contract language, and so it's up to interpretation in some areas. But yes, emergency escalation does not mean Ebro. I think that would be good to understand. So we've definitely had some good conversation, but unfortunately no relation into whether or not that if the costs are still sufficient to cover the critical functions for the Ebro at this point. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to measure. All right, this is Jeff Newman. If you took the limited amount in the COI alone, one COI, it may not cover the costs of an actual transition if it takes place. But if you look at the money that the Ebro is paid by ICANN, and Ebro is also paid, I don't know if it's public or not, a certain amount, and that combined with the eventual release of the COI funds to the registry, if this is ever triggered, that may be enough to fund the cost. But ultimately, what this ultimately leads to is how can we make sure that in the case of a technical failure, registrants are protected by having a backup or multiple backup providers in place to be ready to operate the key critical functions of a registry, at least until a decision could be made as to whether to transition the registry ultimately to another provider or transition the registry out of existence after a certain period of time. That is the ultimate goal of this program, and I believe that one of the things we should do is to explore other mechanisms to fund this program other than through this COI process, which has proven to be very difficult to maintain, very difficult to ensure that ICANN is able to receive the funds immediately if it needed it, and also only lasts the first 6 years of a registry's existence, which to me the problem exists whether it's 2 years from now or 8 years from now. And again, the problem's not with the front end registry in most cases, it's with the back end technical operator.
Jeff, you took all the fun out of our next few slides. We actually do look at the models for that. But Trang, you've patiently been waiting, and we definitely want to hear the feedback from you. So please go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. This is Trang, and for the record, the COI was as much of a headache for us on the program side as it was for the applicants to deal with, if that's any consolation at all. But the point that I wanted to make is that because applications were evaluated on an individual basis, as discussed on the WorkTrack 4 call earlier today, considerations weren't given to the fact that if one TOD failed, it's likely that multiple TODs would fail because the same back-end service provider is typically used by many applicants. I think because of the limitations that we had to work with within the AJB this round, that hadn't really been thought through, and I think that should be a consideration in any sort of recommendations that this work team may want to come out with as it relates to COI. Thanks.
Thank you, Trang. Phil, why don't you take over from there? Sorry.
Sure. Just going back to Jeff's point, it seems like we should be looking at setting up some kind of a fund, and every applicant, like they put an application fee, and then they put in a set fixed fee that goes to cover this problem, and then we could technically grant, and it would be a fixed fee for every applicant across the board. And then we could scrap the COI issue, which is clearly very complicated and controversial. Anyway, shall we move on? Let's move. Let's scroll down. And so then we have the issue with all the timing of all this as well, which is very as you can all see on the screen here. It's complicated and. Is this or is that or whatever? Why does it have to be for a time period of 3 years after termination of the RA, prior to the fifth year? What brought that all about? What's the thinking behind it? I mean, at the end of the day here, as far as I'm aware, every registry has a contract with ICANN for 10 years. So surely these should be in place for 10 years. Do we have any explanations how they arrived at these dates, these periods? Timing. I guess another question to throw back at ICANN.
You know, Jeff, you don't have to chime in on every single question. No, I'm just kidding. Jeff, you've got plenty of opportunities. Just go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. This is Jeff Newman. Again, I don't think that there was a specific formula that was reached. It was It was more a question of, sorry, I'm hearing an echo. It was more of a question of if a registry is technically up for 3 years or 5 years, then it was much less likely to have an issue after the fifth anniversary date. So it's basically playing the odds, saying that if you're successfully operating for a certain period of time, the risk, the probability goes down dramatically after that of having a technical failure. Now, I would say that really applies not to the front-end registry, to the back-end registry. So if you have someone that's been operating for 20 years, let's say as a back-end operator, is there really a risk at all that they're going to go down? You know, again, that's something that we need to think about in a new model. And I put in the chat that what I think we should do is create a small team of people to just kind of explore different alternatives and, you know, the pros and the cons of those alternatives and submit that to the work track to make some progress on it.
Yeah, Jeff, this is Phil here. I totally agree with you, Jeff. I think we definitely should put in a team to have a look at the whole issue. I mean, of course, the thing is, what we're talking about here is the failure of the back end, the technical, but what about the failure of the business as such? I mean, stats are out at the moment, and quite frankly, a lot of these TLDs, they are struggling like mad. Now, what happens if one of them physically runs out of cash? And it can't operate, and therefore it can't pay its back end provider. So they might say, "Well, okay, we're not being paid, so therefore we're service." So what's the implications of that? And where does that tie in with all this? Any thoughts, anybody?
This is Jeff. I think that's really the thinking was. If a business fails and they stop paying their back-end provider, the thinking was back-end was either going to turn it off, which actually I would be surprised if any of the existing back-end operators would actually turn off a TLD, or the back-end would work with ICANN in a way to either transition it to someone that wanted to operate it and could operate it, or transition it out of existence after a certain period of time when it could, you know, provide ample notice to registrants and, you know, make sure that there's time for the registrants to move over or whatnot. So I think that's, it's not scientific, but that was the thinking at the time that the EBROs were being discussed. And really, it was impossible to, because it was known that there would be a wide variety of business models, even if we didn't know what business models would be, that it would be impossible to cost for or evaluate true business failure and how to accommodate that, other than through figuring out what happens if the business failure then causes a technical failure.
So, Jeff, not to steal the thunder, but thank you for that. I'd like to provide a little bit more. Well, I'm not going to provide it, but you can see on the screen the other requirements for the letter of credit, and then also another acceptable form of the COI. I believe from my memory serves me correctly, but from the applicant guidebook, there's the cash cow fund. Am I correct in saying that? I have not seen. I think in other terms, that's just a certain amount of money reserved for reserved to cover these critical functions if necessary. I haven't actually seen that one more specifically myself. I think most of us are very familiar with the LOC, but not cash cow fund. That's my poor American English there. But I think it's There is a second option in the applicant guidebook besides just the letter of credit, and I do think it has to do with a fund, or not necessarily a fund, but just that reserve money But not to get into specific, I think we should be looking at both of those, of course. But so our discussion has kind of been covering a lot of the questions we wanted to ask about whether or not the time period for the COI is sufficient, 6 years, does it need to be changed? Are the requirements for the letter of credit still sufficient? So for those of you that are very familiar with the specific requirements, as well, and if you could look on the page 10 there of what, or sorry, page 11 of what those specific requirements are those still sufficient? And then our last question on this specifically is, can other models besides the letter of credit and the cash escrow deposit, sorry, the cash escrow deposit, what is it, what it's called, be considered for the COI requirements? So we do have, so a lot of our conversation has been covering these three areas, but if anyone else has anything to say about this, we'd very much appreciate that feedback. But I really would like to jump into our last subject here right after the COI today, at least just to bring it up. I think Cheryl brought it up originally. Phil, could you go ahead and take away the last, take up the last subject here? Phil? Can anybody else hear me, or am I talking to myself?
We can hear you, Michael, just not Phil.
I can't hear you, Michael.
Phil, okay. Okay, thank you. All right, Phil, I'm just going to, sorry, I'm not sure any technical difficulties. I'm just going to go with this, and then I'll let everybody else yell at me. But no, I'm just kidding. We very much appreciate everyone. But the last area that we'd like to look at is considering when registrant protections don't apply. To be very blunt, whether or not the measures like the registrant protections, you know, the EBRO or the COI to actually protect registrants, whether or not that's actually necessary was on the notion that there would always be registrants. However, lo and behold, with some of the models that we've seen come out of this current round, certain cases like dot brands or other possible closed exclusive use registries do not always have registrants. And this such, in this, considering this factor, would the registrant protections be considered necessary for them? And that runs into our last, I'm trying to figure out which slide is which. To our last question. So, should more relevant rules be established for certain specific cases or categories of TLDs? Does anyone have any feedback? Come on, Jeff. That was a joke earlier. You can, you're free to say something. Oh, Ruben.
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to point out that different types of brand TLDs. There are some where the brand is actually the only user of the TLD, but there are some where registrants are brand licensees and could be a very diverse population than the brand. So even in a single category, Spectre team eligible TLDs, there are possibly some shades of gray in where one needs protection and one does not need protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben. So you're jumping on the factor that even within brands themselves, there are different layers or there are different shades of gray. I like that. There are different shades of gray of whether or not there are registrants and whether or not they do need protection. Does anyone else have any input on this? Cheryl, you were touching on this subject earlier. Did you want to add to? Oh, you have to drop off the phone for the next slide. Okay. So we don't have Cheryl anymore. Does anyone have anything else in regards to this? I know personally myself, working with a lot of brand TLDs, the COI, well, more specifically than just registration protections, of course, but if you open up the registration protections, even for a brand model, the eBro is not only a good idea, it's probably the most necessary idea to be able to fall back on that. But then again, there's the other aspect that, you know, not having that COI would be the best, you know, best headache medicine that we all could have. But it's one aspect I've tried to look at in the past, is if you can have one without the other. Of course, that would be very difficult, but yes. Rubens makes a point that eBro without COI could be best of both worlds. I can't read. Jeff also makes a statement that I believe that since we now have a number of years under our belt, we could use that data to seek proposals from eBros, past or future, to see if there is a fixed annual fee that could be paid for the year to cover any eventually, given that eBro's obligations are very limited. Any eventually occurrence of the eBro perhaps. But, Jeff, I knew you'd jump in here. Anyway, yes.
Yeah, sorry. This is Jeff. So I guess my point is that if you went to a existing eBro or even any other provider that could provide those eBro services, and you said to them, if you did an RFC for comments, what would it take to compensate you for an entire year so that you could stand ready, given the data we already have of how often eBros are being used, given the obligations you know that would happen if an eBro ever is called up, what would it cost you to do that for a year with basically no questions asked? I'm sure you would get an amount that would be pretty high, but not high enough or not higher than a COI from every single registry. Even if a eBro came back and said, you know what, you'd have to pay me $500,000 a year in order for me to cover what we expect would be at most 10 or 20 eBro occasions in the year. Even if you came up with that and you had three eBros at $500,000 apiece, that's a $1.5 million total pool of money you would need. Now, that money could be either come out of, I dare say, the auction funds. It could come out of application fees. It could come out of registrant fees. There are many proposals you could make to basically contract out permanent eBro services, especially now given that we've launched 1,200 TLDs and it's never been invoked, right? I'm sure you could find providers that are willing to take the chance and bid on that contract.
Thank you, Jeff. That is a really good idea as well. I just want to say that I'm sorry, but we have reached our time. Kurt has brought up some very good feedback, as well as Phil Morano. And perfect. They're added to the notes. That's always is one step ahead of me. Thank you. So we have reached our time. It's 6 a.m. here in Tokyo. I'm going to have a cookie before going back to sleep. But once again, thank you very much for joining us this week, and we'll see you again at the beginning of February. Terry, take us away. Thank you. Oh, sorry, Terry, you can end the recording.
Thank you. Nope, I was just coming off mute. Sorry about that. As a reminder, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day. That does end the conference for today.